Greetings wherever you are and whatever time it is in the world, and welcome to Beyond Bitcoin. I'm Derek Graham, I'm CEO of Portal Asset Management, who are advisors to the Portal Digital Fund, who are an active investor in this particular space. I'm delighted to share every one of these events with my friend and colleague, Nitin Gower. Over to you, Nitin, to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Derek. Really glad to be here. My name is Nitin Gower. I currently serve as Director of Financial Sciences and Digital Assets at IBM. I was also the person behind founding the Blockchain Labs and subsequently Digital Asset Labs. And my current involvement with Derek is that I serve as a CTO as well as research for Portal Asset Management. So we spend a lot of time discussing industry and figuring out our MO, and glad to be here, Derek.
Thanks, Nitin. And look, the reason we're having this is not just because there's so much to talk about beyond Bitcoin, but because Nitin and I spend a lot of time talking together. And we decided that one day, why don't we just record this and let people enjoy this conversation? So hopefully you'll enjoy it. If you don't, of course, you won't listen to it any longer. But in the meantime, let's just sort of set a bit of a scene for this. This, you know, Bitcoin obsession of the Bitcoin maximalist, you know, may I apologize, this is not about you. Bitcoin is extraordinary, and we look at it as an amazing prototype created, you know, by, of course, Satoshi Nakamoto, he, she, or they, a long time back in 2009, and it will always play a role in the future of cryptocurrency. However, things are changing. There's now a total capitalization as of this week of $2.3 trillion for digital assets around the world. Now, 44% of that is Bitcoin. Or 56% of that isn't Bitcoin. And there are about 10,000 tokens throughout the world, covering obviously native currencies, some central bank currencies now, protocols, NFTs, securities, et cetera. And it's that which we're really interested in talking about. So just a couple of quick stats around that, just to set that scene. Coinbase just recently announced some of their statistics for their second quarter. Always interesting to see, because they do announce solid statistics for us to get some guidance. 28% of all the trades on Coinbase were for Ethereum. 26% were for Bitcoin. And I think it's healthy that we'll see that Bitcoin percentage changing over the years. What do you think, Nitin?
No, absolutely. I think we've seen that shift. And I think some stats to add on to your stats, not like we have enough dearth of stats in this industry per se, is that for the first time, I think we've seen, for example, Uniswap make $1 billion in fees, which is interesting stat by itself, that since inception. We've seen Coinbase, which is what you cited, has decided to invest $500 million. Into crypto, but also dedicate 10% of all their profits into the space, which is basically fueling the industry of which they benefit from. In many cases, again, you cited the number of DeFi and overall crypto reaching $2.3 trillion. To me, I think that we've already seen the shift that you talk about, that Bitcoin was the dominant, and it still is in terms of the first currency, the first love that many of us had with crypto. But you begin to look into various use cases. And like, for example, we see Ethereum as one of the, you know, this time we've seen that, you know, NFTs have overtaken DeFi in transaction volume. And NFT is fairly a new concept. But NFT, besides on Ethereum as a layer one protocol, it's also dominant on other competing platforms. For example, Dapper Flow and Solana. And this week we've seen a growth in their transaction volume as well. So I think the title of this conversation is Beyond Bitcoin is apt, because we've begun to see the rise of many other macroeconomic elements popping up in the space, where you see NFTs, and then we'll talk more about NFTs hopefully at some point. But those numbers are exponentially growing in different facets of this industry. So it's exciting times, but it's also a time to take inventory of, again, our thinking behind, one, where do we invest and how do we understand the space, which is growing much bigger and profoundly growing beyond just the Bitcoin as a conceptual element of what the changes it brings about, I think.
Yes, that's right. Look, it's extraordinary. You talk about corporate investment in that. I mean, you know, as Portal, we actually reinvest part of what we do into the space too, because we're great believers in it. But we're of course seeing Microsystems do the same thing. He's legendary for that. And as he says, you know, I borrowed $600 million at 0.75% into the traditional finance industry, TradFi, as he calls it, to return, to give them double the return in 30 days and go on to see a $700 million profit. So there's no question that you're seeing some of these bigger treasuries starting to operate and invest in this space. And look, their first investments are likely to be in Bitcoin because they understand it and they think it's a, you know, it's an area, it's you know, represents some sort of a digital gold through that process. But I think, you know, Bitcoin, CBDC, central bank digital currencies, PayPal, and this is an unusual bundle I'm throwing together for you here, Nitin, right? But they all represent on-ramps. They all represent on-ramps to this bigger space. You know, we often refer to Bitcoin as the entry drug into this space. But if the masses can enter this space, then we'll start seeing things happen. A little while ago, we talked about tipping points. Remember that? We said, where is the tipping point? In fact, I asked Michael Casey from CoinDesk this question. Where is the tipping point? What are your thoughts about it? Where's the tipping point? Or is there going to be a tipping point, Nitin?
Yeah, no. So a few things, right? We are in the, I would say, inflection point at the moment. And as you know, whether we can create the vernacular around inflection point is when we begin to see a change apparent. And then tipping point becomes the fact that it becomes mainstream and everybody's talking about it, everybody has it. And I always draw analogy with internet, right? So if you look at the evolution of internet, which was designed for exchange information, and we've always compared internet as evolution of internet and what it's done for us, like the unicorns that have been born 20, 25 years later. Yes. That to me is the tipping point. Like what Amazon and Baidu and Alibaba are doing is the tipping point of saying you cannot really survive and do business without. But that tipping point took us almost 2 decades in the internet era when you realized we were exchanging information, we were reading news, we were exchanging URLs, and no longer we do that anymore, right? Because now, after certain protocol evolution, we were comfortable buying airline tickets, we were comfortable banking. That became a tipping point to say, you know, this becomes an essential service. So if you were to take the comparison to where we are in blockchain journey, and we oftentimes compare blockchain to what internet has done for information, which makes information dissemination easier, faster, accessible to all, we expect blockchain to do something similar for digital assets, right? And if you take the context in practice, look, Derek, we are in finance and we try to understand the space. And even for people like us, it's effort. So you can imagine a common man, finance is not the most interesting topic for most people, right? They make money, they borrow their land, they do basic activities around it. But if you were to expand that to, you know, the notion of illiquid assets, the things that we value, that we have. So I think that, you know, to me, the inflection point is NFTs or non-fungible tokens. And maybe I can take a few minutes to explain to our audience what that is, right? In the era of Bitcoin and Ethereum, there were this digital assets or crypto assets that were defined by crypto economic systems, which basically meant that there are a few ways to earn this, which was very black boxy and it was only available to technical people. And over time, that evolution in the past 12 years, I would say, since inception of Bitcoin, we have come to build systems that have appealed to our inner sense to own things that we love. So we all love sports. So we all love art. We all love painting. And we like to have a piece of anything we love, whether it's my basketball player and the best slam dunk Michael Jordan had or best home run that any baseball player would have. And cricket, for example, I'm an Indian and I love my cricket. So we all have our little moments in the sports history and we like to own a piece of that. And so, you know, what we have seen recently is the evolution of that space. Now, what that has done is in terms of sports, in terms of, is redefined how we treat media, is redefined digital rights management that, you know, and we have seen that with, you know, recently with, I don't know if you've seen the ad of Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher, that they have produced a movie. And the only way for you to watch a movie is to buy an NFT, which gives you digital rights to access the content. So this is a new evolution of what Netflix could be in future as something we can envision. The question then becomes that that's mainstream. That's inflection point, in my opinion, that suddenly owning a token that gives you access to content, owning a token that gives you a sense of ownership and pride in your sports history, that you want to be part of the history because you own it. I think that to me is the inflection point that we're going through, which makes all of this ubiquitous. And that ubiquity will lead to adoption.
So what we're seeing then is little cuts at the main system. And those are micro, or not so much micro, but they're small on ramps to them. Whether you end up entering this space because you happen to love a particular football player, or because you're in a country that's gone to a central business, a central digital bank currency, or whether at last Amazon has a token that's out, you've entered it. And once you've entered the space, that's when you'll start seeing all the other options in there. You know, if we could talk a little bit more about non-fungible tokens and how broad they are, you know, there's no question that you and I are just theorizing about where it's going to go. It reminds me of, you know, early days in the 80s where we were turning around and saying, you know, one day you're going to put entire movies on these CDs, you know, and then you turn around and saying, right, in the 90s, you're going, one day you're going to have a USB plug so extensive that you'll be able to keep the world libraries of music on it. But the fact of the matter is that what we tend to do is we extrapolate out our current knowledge and our current belief systems into the future. And when I was considering whether that USB plug would exist, which one day it might, it doesn't matter because music is streamed. And so much of that is the way this industry is going to. We're expecting NFTs to occur and look a certain way, but we really don't know how ultimately they may look, because they will vary constantly. Social NFTs that are coming out are quite extraordinary. You know, the ability for an artist, by example, to turn around and say, follow me. If you like what I'm doing, follow me, buy one of my NFTs. And then if you do own one of my NFTs, you have the right to buy a piece of my art. And by the way, you might not be the only one that buys that piece of that art if we choose that way, and many people could own a piece of that art and it could be kept at the art gallery. And so it starts changing the dynamics. But what's clearly happening is this extraordinary decentralization of assets, the democratization of assets, which is so delicious to look at that. Because what you're seeing there is you're seeing something that could be an extraordinary piece of art, $2-3 million, owned by 50-100,000 people and throughout the world. And if that's not democratization of assets, I mean, you know, what is? So I want to add one more thing there, and that is on a kind of, you know, a more corporatized aspect. I'm sorry, but it's the world I come from. You know, over the years, I've listed four companies on the Australian Stock Exchange, so I'm kind of used to that whole what is I'd like to refer now to as siloed exchanges. And so people often say to me, you know, so why would Bitcoin be worth this amount of money when there are 10,000 tokens? That immediately makes me realize their knowledge of this space is damn close to zero. But this 10,000 token thing, I very quickly say to them, well, why in 10 years' time there should be 10 million tokens? And they go, well, why would there be that many? Well, I go, let's look at it this way. There's 635,000 listed companies on stock exchanges around the world. Yeah. And they currently have totally analog stock. You have a voting right of one degree or another. You have a dividend right, and you have the right to be able to sell it. And that's it. Okay. You don't get share certificates any longer. So there's a degree of electronics there, but digitization there, but that's it. Could you imagine a company that turns around, particularly say a consumer facing company that turns around like a hardware store? There's one such company in Australia that's extremely well known called Bunnings, owned by Wesfarmers. And that hardware store, if you were a shareholder of that hardware store and you owned a token, a non-fungible token representing that shareholder, then every time you shopped at that hardware store, you could get a benefit. Every time you transacted in some form or other, that benefit could come back on your non-fungible token that's connected to your shareholding. And by the way, that token can be purchased in India, in the US, in the UK, et cetera. And that doesn't exist now. We live in these siloed worlds with relatively, I'm sorry, dumb stock that's out there. So the path of non-fungible tokens is going to be extraordinary and not one that's easily predicted.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant segue, right? You know, we've been talking about this for quite some time. Internet is a global information platform, right? And if barring the banking system, which is localized in every country because you have regulation and you have banks and you have rails that allows you to move money in their respective sovereign currencies to be able to entry into the crypto space, which is what we've seen for people who are not technologists, who are not miners. You know, I'm not sitting in mining, neither are you, Derek. I don't see any mining equipment in your room behind you. For us to be able to participate in this, we have two avenues. We either be a part of the ecosystem, which is providing the apparatus, providing the compute power to secure systems and be part of it, or take a part of what we have from the real world wealth that we've acquired over time and use banking rails to move it. But if you look at Ethereum, for example, or Bitcoin, these are truly global systems in the sense that if you had Ether today, you could be anywhere in the world and you could participate in hundreds and thousands of tokens that's out there, which allows you to use Ether as a fungible currency, like a US dollar or Australian dollar, and exchange that. So Ether gives you the value, a singular fungible value with singular value points anywhere in the world. And if you don't touch the fiat, you have the ability to, you know, participate in the transaction, whether the transaction is simply transfer or transaction happens to be to your point of exchanging that for different asset classes, collateralizing it for value growth and other business aspects anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And so what that does for us is it truly gives us the notion of a truly global exchange, a global platform for value exchange. And so I think that is a profound concept that suddenly now what maybe the 21 or 23 million people in Australia who could be part of this Bunnings, as example described, very localized. But imagine you're truly creating global brands.
Yes.
That, you know, like what Messi has done recently. I don't know if you've seen his recent signings that he moved to a football, you know, soccer, sorry, football is the whole concept in the United States. But from soccer perspective, you're creating a brand that allows you to own Messi fan tokens, that gives you special access to Messi memorabilia and Messi and any sports person that I follow. You're creating a social token, gives you privileges, gives you interest, lets your investment, whether it's in time or whether it's in interest or whether it's in pure fan value, grow over time and allowing you to transfer it. Like, hey, I'm in 20 years, which is what we do with our things that we, like, for example, if I have a cricket bat, which 12 signatures that I've had from Indian cricket team, for example, I'm going to pass it on as heirloom to my kids, right? And that has a value over time. Imagine the same level of transfer ability that for 20 years I've been following an athlete or have a painting or have access to these things. Tremendous amount of potential allowing us to continuously pass this on to generations or to other individuals, other fans, and collective value of other fans, which can participate in a special event to say, hey, we need X amount of fan tokens to really go and meet Messi, for example. Yeah. And, you know, we can create a group and collectively all can go, you know, unlimited possibilities in a global brand perspective, I think,
and
to your point.
So much more powerful than, you know, when I was a kid, I had swap cards, you know, football swap cards. And I love them. I used to go through them all the time. They smelled like bubble gum, of course. I used to go through them all the time and I'd look at them and I'd spot them and I'd try to get the best position of it. And I'd really love certain stars, you know, but I couldn't engage at this level. And this digital, the digital natives that are now Generation X, Y, and Z that are now out are expecting to engage at that level, and they can, and their creativity will be extraordinary. And so therefore, you know, it's going to be beyond us to predict where that's going to be in X number of years' time. I love the fact that people often say, you know, this is where crypto is going to be in 5 to 10 years' time. Well, we don't know where it's going to be in 18 months.
I don't know, it's only 3 months. Every time I do a presentation, Eric, I show stats and those stats are outdated. This is like week after week after.
Yes.
So it's a challenge even creating presentations for crypto these days. The numbers are just, you know, and just to throw some more stats, 14% of Americans today in the past 12 years now exchanging and active in crypto, just 14%, which is still a small number. And that's in a developed economy. And I would imagine the numbers are the same in most parts of the world. What's interesting is we had 880% growth from 2020 to 2021 in people who've gotten into crypto. Yeah. So to your point, that there is an exponent, there's still a long way to go. The question becomes, what do we as human beings want to do with it?
We want to use it for
our own evolution, our cultural evolution, create a new financial systems, create new communities. And that's the question that I think we should be asking ourselves. The technology is there. How do we use it to progress our cause?
Gosh, there's going to be a topic. I think we'll have to tag that as a topic for one of our future talks. Nothing but the human and social impact of this. Hey, that 880%, that came from a group called Insights. I just happen to have them up on the screen here. And it was quite intriguing because they did an analysis of 154 countries, and they put the top 20 of those countries out there. And the analysis, it was filtered in a manner of, wrapped around wealth and transactions for investment, et cetera, to get down to the raw usage of cryptocurrencies as a payment system or as a utility token, et cetera, quite intriguing. So here you go. So who do you think the number one country in, and I think you've seen this, but who do you think the number one country in the world for crypto usage is, Nitin?
So I have not seen it. Only because I go for my runs and I listen to some two or three podcasts, and these numbers, it allows me to be effective and use my time wisely because I read a lot anyway, as we all have to in this industry. I would think, and this is an interesting question, that I'm thinking, so China had a ban. So I'm going to not say China because they have the numbers, they have the technology. I'm going to stick with either United States, and this is going to be diabolically opposite ends, either United States or Southeast Asian country, whether it's Philippines or one of those countries, if I'm not mistaken.
All right. So, I mean, you went on a double bet there, frankly, that's unfair, but here we go. And so the number one in the country, in the world rather, was Vietnam. Number one user.
Southeast Asian. I mean, I was close.
Yeah, that's right. You got half of it. But I'll roll through it. So number two is India. Number three is Pakistan. Number four is Ukraine. Number five is Kenya. Number six is Nigeria. Number seven is Venezuela. Have I mentioned any major fully developed countries yet?
No, that's the point. I think that's an observation, I think. And now I'm bummed. I should have read that so I could feel smarter on this show, on this podcast. But I think that's a telling sign, right, Derek, in the sense that there's a need for it. And as a few minutes back, we were discussing, what do we want to do with this technology? That's your answer. Vietnam and Venezuela and Pakistan and India, they figured out a way to solve a problem because technology lets them solve the problem of currencies and dealing with solving some of the local problems, which they may not have access directly. And I'll say one more thing, which comes to mind, and the reason why I'm in Philippines, because in my last run, I was going through this Axie Infinity, which is a gaming company and gaming companies trying to, and they had this NFT similar to what Pokemon, and I'm not a gamer, so I cannot relate to it. My son is. And it's one way to sort of collect. And because of pandemic, many of the folks were affected with jobs and had the restaurant jobs were affected. And the entire village got onto this Axie Infinity because they had access to internet and they had access to phones. And they were able to make $400 a month as a family, which is more than what they would make anywhere to put food on the table.
Yes.
They participated in this economic system to harvest these. Apparently, there are some eggs that you harvest and they grow into other NFT tokens and you can trade the NFT tokens. And Philippines overnight created an exchange that today, to take an NFT, you have to convert NFT into Ether 2. So there's a whole sort of roundabout way to convert a secondary asset into Ether or Bitcoin or Solana or any of the primary assets. But there were exchanges now which popped up serving the need and community to convert those Axie Infinity NFT tokens directly into Filipino pesos. And I thought that one, fantastic, for whatever reason, that you're creating global marketplace. While many of the Western economies may have extra fringe income and they may want to buy these rare Axie Infinity tokens, and that money is, again, in form of Ether or any other token is going into the system. Somewhere in Philippines, you have an exchange that popped up overnight, converting those tokens into pesos, enabling in many ways true real-time transfer of global wealth.
Yes.
I think it's fantastic to just to see that happen, whether it's happening implicitly or explicitly, or the system that's been created, they found a way. So humanity always finds a way to solve. And I think that was fantastic to just go through that, because in my mind, I'm thinking, working for a bank, designing payment systems in what I do in my day job, if I were to do that for a payment system, Derek, it would take me 18 months to figure that out. And this is almost done within a matter of 3 weeks.
It's incredible. And that's the democratization of technology.
Sure.
And you know, one would argue that that's also without governments getting involved and interrupting it. Now, I'm not a libertarian, as you know, and so I'm not the sort of the original Bitcoin libertarian in this space. I believe in governments. I believe in social support for systems. And you and I have discussed this before. But there are places and there are areas that it's a good idea that governments and infrastructure just steps away from, as far as I'm concerned, and doesn't involve themselves in it. And so, look, a while ago, I was roaming through some slides to argue a proposition for a group of people that asked me to speak. And a good slide deck I was pillaging from, of course, was one of your slide decks, Nitin. And it had the fact that there's 1.7 billion unbanked. And yeah. This particular slide within your slide was from the banking industry saying, we're after it. We're chasing that 1.7 billion unbanked. Well, I'm sorry, guys. I think that's going to be the first generation of unbanked yeah. people in the world, because those guys are going to be able to do this in a digital manner without the banks interrupting their life and controlling them. What do you think in that area? I mean, so obviously already it's getting shown here with the Philippines and Ghana. By the way, number 20 of the top 20, Afghanistan. You know, so your question is, sorry, United States sits at number 8 and China sits at number 11. Well done, China, for banning it. But they're number 11 in the world.
And, you know, I'm glad that number 11 is something, which, you know, which is not a bad thing for even US being number 8. And it's yep. time again, which to me, the thesis that we formed, this is when, if you look at the early days of paper of Satoshi Nakamoto, the thesis of the genesis of Bitcoin was just that, is to free the system and create a model that allows. And again, I'm with you that there has to be a certain element of regulation, and we can spend a whole chapter on what happened last week in the United States regulation element. But going back to 1.7 unbanked, also very profound number. And I think there's unbanked and underbanked. And I believe that about 40% of world's, which is the stats that we have gotten from working with our banks, are either unbanked or underbanked, which means they don't have access to the exception of deposits. Now, if you remember, I'll draw an analogy with M-Pesa. So M-Pesa, old project, everybody knows about in the world. We have beaten this example to death in every presentation back in the day, is the power of mobile money. So M-Pesa birth was purely on a telco-based model to say, let me just transfer minutes between these different countries. And that gave birth to, and at the time, actually, I went to Uganda, spent a week to understand the system, to say, how does this work? And then I realized there's about $22 million collective dollars between Tanzania, Uganda, and some of the neighboring countries transferring using minutes, just transferring minutes. Wow. I would go to a shop, and I met the banks, and then, you know, you could see the Citibanks of the world salivating over that, look, we're missing out on this 22 million. Well,
yeah.
Today the story is different. Today, Safaricom has banked with some bank behind the scenes. It's been completely regulated. So even though you're using your phone for mobile payments, but if I were to bring that analogy to today's world, it's going to play out differently. I think an example again, Philippines, Afghanistan, there is a need for it. And suddenly now you find a new viable currency that's acceptable in as many locations as US dollar is today. Right. And it gives an avenue for, in general, people to find a unit of account, which is fungible, right? Mm-hmm. Which is acceptable anywhere. You can spend that anywhere in the world, as long as you have access to a network. With the right walleting mechanism. Yes, it's still a bit clunky with key management and everything else, but let's say we solve that problem. And that is an attractive element that, you know, at that point, all we have to solve is digital divide. So making sure the unbanked or underbanked who are today have access to a network and a device. And that's all you need at that point. And then you've solved the problem. And even if they don't, I think they'll, you know, as all emergencies and all, you know, all crisis finds a way, there will be mechanism, as you mentioned. Afghanistan is now suddenly looking into, you know, creating these elements. Very powerful metric, I think, Eric.
Hey, you've got some distant background in India. And I think India's population is around 900 million to a billion. You'll probably know the exact number, et cetera. I know that you've done some advice there to high level government officials. India, what's interesting there is I understand their uptake of digital phones in the last 36 months has been, digital phones, smartphones, has been extraordinary. And it is bringing India into a new realm. Yet they seem to be backpedaling on the adoption of digital currencies. Why is that, Nitin?
Yeah, that's a great question too. So one thing, it's 1.3 plus billion, which is a big number today.
Yeah.
And I think India, so the two things, reason why that's the case. One is the infrastructure in India, which is what United States and Australia went through when we had coax cables, the copper running into the homes, and we switched to fiber. And we had the normal telephone lines, and they bypassed the entire generation that the phone lines were there in cities. And the tier 2, tier 3 and small villages didn't really have the infrastructure. And the moment mobile devices came about, you know, there was less incentive to invest in the ground infrastructure. So they completely, you know, bypassed a few generations and went straight to 3G and above.
Yes.
And that led to service capabilities, and that also led to many of the Chinese phone manufacturers provide super cheap devices that not everybody is able to afford, iPhones and Samsungs. And I think while there is significant digital penetration, I think as India, as, and I was listening to Michael Casey's podcast this afternoon while on my run, he talked about, they brought actually an Indian economist and human rights activist talking about the Indian sort of system for digital identity. So India has the largest digital identity system in the whole world. And so they have digitized a bunch of these frameworks, but the main thing in India, which is always an issue, is it's still a very cash rich economy. A lot of things happen in cash for many reasons. There are historical reasons, there's cultural reasons, but there's also reasons of fact that a lot of capital markets works in pretty interesting ways in India. And so the government is trying to really push for, and they've introduced many bills. They've talked about Paytm, which is, you know, a SoftBank and an Alipay company, trying to digitize all payments. The focus is now controlling anything above $1,000 in payments and everything else. There's a whole lot of focus on digitizing payment because that digitization of payments does two things. It allows tracking and tracing easily done, but at the same time, it stops. Or it prevents the dark money or black money, as India calls it, because if you have no cash, then it's hard to make those nefarious transactions, which is purely cash and anonymous. So many of these are leading to them saying that if we want to get rid of cash, while we're still dealing with dark money and black money and nefarious activity in the country, which leads to some level of terrorist adoption. So the conversation we are having with the government official is one, we should look into this because it gives us an avenue to track and trace in a much more profound fashion. But the main concern is, will this system or this network be used for any nefarious acts? Similar to what the United States has in terms of use of Bitcoin for money laundering and drug enforcement and so on and so forth.
But that's surely, that's ignorance. That's not a worry. That's ignorance. That means they don't understand how the system works.
Yeah, I think in that sense of an apparatus, absence of regulatory framework and absence of the ability to monitor, which is what I think US has really done an amazing job in the past 2 years, I would say, in investing a lot of money and time and tools and technology and training the law enforcement entities. And we have recommended India to focus on things like, you know, safe harbor to promote innovation and be at par with China, which is the neighbor, and they have contentious relationships. At the same time, focusing on innovation technology, but, you know, having the framework and tooling to be able to get away from, you know, ignorance, as you rightly put it.
Yeah, that's right. So I was in India in 2014 in Ubud Pradesh, right up in the north, and I was there on a Buddhist pilgrimage. For the Americans listening, that's a Buddhist pilgrimage, and it was fascinating. Really, I was more of a religious tourist, and of course, this is the birthplace of Buddha and where he passed, and you know, he lived within 100 miles, and we were going through pretty simple villages back then. It was lovely to see. I mean, we're talking mud huts and straw roofs and these sort of things. It was very, very simple. And I had then with me my whichever version of Apple it was, phone, that was 3G connected to the world as I was out there amongst these villages. They had no power. They had no telegraph lines going through to the places, but they were 3G connected. It was extraordinary. And it just made me think there's a great opportunity for leveling to occur through this system. You know, that topic of money laundering and this is such an emotive area. And whenever anyone asks me about this, I always quote a US professor from NYU, David. Remember him, the professor from NYU? Great guy. And he just kept on saying, America, of all the currencies they've printed in its history, the largest percentage of notes are US $100 bills. Now, come on, guys. Why are you printing US $100 bills? Because your average citizen's just got a wallet full of them? Of course not. They're printing US dollar bills because they're exporting money by the ton, because it's a fabulous way of being able to generate it. What happens to that money? Oh, when it's overseas, it's not our issue.
That's right.
And, you know, it is philosophically, not very nice, frankly. However, what it goes to show you is that if you've got that, if you're a central bank digital currency and you release that on a blockchain, you can track that money. And that money becomes real and it becomes useful and it becomes valid on the way through. However, this is my question to you, Nitin, as I throw out here. I don't know if America wants all that money back. Do you know if it wants it all back to be able to pay on a...
Well, I don't know if it wants it back. I will say this, though, and I think you froze. I don't know if it's just me or... But I'll say this, though, that the same conversation we are having, I just had this conversation with some of the government officials in the US. Same argument to say, hey, it takes today, by the way, in this day and age with all the technology, about 45% of all financial crimes are prosecuted. The remaining 55% go unnoticed, or there's just not enough manpower to go after them. So they go after the most important ones and leave the smaller ones altogether.
Right. Yes.
And this conversation I had with you is saying, you know, like most of the crimes that have been conducted on Bitcoin or supposedly have been caught instantly. There's ability for us to track and trace, ability for us to distill down the node or a wallet to IP address, figure out which house. There's all kinds of stuff that we can do, and it's all in real time. So our argument is have the right tools, have the right knowledge, and have the ability. And one thing, the reason why I think the US is a little behind with USD and central bank digital currency, which is sort of using the same technology that Bitcoin and Ethereum and other cryptocurrencies use for its transfer, with the exception of how they are created, in which case any sovereign currency would be an act of central bank and backed by legislation, all the control mechanisms that are in place, is the fact that US currency is supposedly global reserve and global currency of sorts that many country and much of, I would say my last stats was about 87% of still all trade still happens in US dollars. There's a little risk to US prominence, and many of us, and this has been debated with central banks, is will US benefit from digitizing it? And many of us think it will, one, because of technical prowess. Second thing is you're suddenly increasing the velocity of money movement around the world because no longer has to go through this painful cross-border and correspondent banking system for clearing and everything else. So that debate ensues, but I would agree with you. I think whether US wants the money back or not, like in most cases, the money supply works if there's more demand for it, if there's more velocity for it, and if there's just about enough supply to keep the value of the dollar. So again, looking at monetary stability and financial stability, which is a central bank function, I think they're in good place at the moment. But it's, again, like everything else, the point in time statement.
So you know, that was, do they want it back, was a little bit of a flippant statement, because I think they've exported it for somewhat nefarious reasons. But hell, it's just a cynical view on the whole thing. But looking at a more utopian view, as you say, it's about 83% of the world's trade is denominated in US dollars. However, they represent about 25% of the world's business. In other words, heavily disproportionately leaning towards a US dollar currency. As a sort of a utopian view of this, you know, you could develop a smart contract that aggregated the top 20 currencies, basket of currencies, and the top 20 commodities, basket of commodities, in a smart contract that was constantly aggregating and came up with a world token, a world currency that was predominantly stable. You'd see it grow and drop against, you know, sections of, you know, other aspects. After all, I mean, if you've got some gold that sits in there, your global currency would rise and fall against gold because it only represents one of the resources that is getting represented there. And you, if you have real estate in a certain country, the value of your real estate can rise and fall against that country. That would take away from the world's fight between China and Russia, wants to guess, and the US, and provide a global digital currency. Now, apart from the obvious, which is every prize-fighting country in the world wants to be the one, why couldn't we do that? Why couldn't the globe go into one currency?
It's literally a $37 trillion question, I think, is, so Libra tried that in terms of, so two things. At the moment, we, and this is something which I have been debating for the longest time. So I've spent a lot of time in figuring out the SDRs, the special drawing rights, the basket currencies, and how a token derives its value, right? A stablecoin is one-to-one mapping. And the moment you tie a token to a basket currency, suddenly now you need to have a trusted mechanism to balance things out. But remember this, the data that is attached to, so at the end of the day, what is money? Money is a communication mechanism of exchanging things of value. It's a meme. It's the old meme, you know, of our times. And if you look at as to how a currency derives its value, we have built some arbitrary measurements, so GDP and balance of payments and total money supply and contractual vehicles and productivity and all that good stuff. For smart contract to be effective, you need some way for this to derive information that is still very arbitrarily locked in many systems, you know, in general. But I've argued this, Derek, and just think about this, that what if we were to treat truly decentralized currency, and as an American citizen, I would like the dollar to be demanded. I would like, it's in my best interest as an American, that as long as dollar is the king, my travel, my quality of life, my standard of living is always high because, you know, the value of dollar and the value of the passport, value of who we are, and what country we represent, is always high.
Yes.
But I was just thinking that what if we were to, and this is the question I've actually asked regulators too, that what if this entire regulatory discussion and regulatory arbitrage is there because we are dealing with the banking rails and the existing fiat, existing sovereign currency coming into the crypto world as an exchange mechanism? What if I rely on a system that allows me to simply exchange the other cryptocurrencies in the world? There are, as we have done in our research, Derek, 11,600 plus different currencies in the world. And we find about 120 plus meaningful of, you know, the rest is all still either emerging or unproven, untested. But let's say we have 100 of these currencies, which is still less than a global collection of all the sovereign currencies in the world. Will that speed things up? Will that create regulatory challenges? Because at the end of the day, we aren't touching the banking system. So banking system is going, humming along, doing all the work. But let's say if trade begins to happen on using Ethereum as a medium of exchange and transfer of value, not necessarily unit of account. And eventually, you know, it reaches some level where I can simply convert them to a stable coin or CBDC of sorts. I question that sometimes. And I know it's a deeper and lot to unpack there. Which to me no longer is a debate on, because this week stablecoin has come into a lot of focus the last 2 weeks, both from Gary Gensler in the US and everywhere else, to say, okay, we have to control stablecoin for financial stability. And the bunch of debates happening both as a payment infrastructure, but also as a payment instrument. And I'm thinking, well, as long as we are tying to our existing financial rails, we will continue to have the same problems. And maybe it's an interest,
correct,
but what if we were to rely completely on this new system, which is, if I do a CBDC, does that solve the problem?
Well, I agree with you. I think it's an interim step, but it's an important interim step that it occurs. You know, look, getting back to sort of the concept of democratization and international trade, I know you've done quite a bit of work with IBM for Maersk Shipping, I think, along the way. And even talked with the Singapore
Port Authority.
Yep.
NMAS, yeah.
Exactly. So these are all really interesting groups you're sort of putting together. Can you see this? It's a shipping group, a port authority group, a monetary authority system there in place, et cetera. Why is that occurring? Because Singapore wants to be a digital trading environment. They want to be able to move shipping in and out of there efficiently and effectively. So let's just go on a short-term fantasy ride of what that might look like versus a dollar transaction with banking. There's a group in Africa, and that group in Africa turns around and goes, we have come together as a village, and we've built all of this maybe beautiful artifacts. And they're going to go in a container, and we're going to ship that via Singapore to some other location, okay? And they're not dealing with a bank. They've got a token, and that token's got a smart contract on it, and the smart contract that says when they passed latitude of this, then the GPS tracking device connected to the container triggers, and you are paid your money. And as it arrives into the Singapore area, they know that money's paid on this. The village is paid. The container arrives, and off it goes from there. Now, what's missing from this picture? Well, a letter of credit's missing from the picture. Exchange hedge funding is missing from the picture.
Yeah.
Banking is missing from the picture. And that is extraordinary, because that means that people in countries around the world can start trading without banks sitting in the middle going, no, I'm not going to give you a letter of credit for this. And no, I'm not going to do that for you. And no, you have to be this size for this to occur. You know, in my theory there, that village could come together as one and get a container load of artifacts in there and get it across the world and receive a token for it triggered by a latitude passing position and by an Internet of Things device. That's not too utopian, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, I'll tell you, the early days of blockchain, because supply chain or trade logistics is relatively less regulated than, or let's say it's less, it has less burden of regulation than, let's say, financial systems in general, because of the checks involved and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So what the journey that you described for us started from trade logistics, tracking and tracing, culpability. And I have been to at least 5 different ports. It's just interesting because you have to design the systems, you have to actually go to these ports, understand the shipping and how they store containers and how often they move it, what are the tax structure. So I went to Peru and I went to Panama Canal and I looked. So it was an amazing learning experience to understand these things. Not utopian. In fact, we built the system where, you know, things like taxation. So we have 3 layers. One is the logistics layer, which is tracking and tracing and latitude and smart contract paying 10% every time. You know, so the banking, which is financing this whole thing, they de-risk their investment because they know exactly where things are, which today is sort of fairly opaque. They know the port authorities don't have to inspect every single container because now you have a way to record, which has been there for quite some time with IoT devices, which are Internet of Things, to say, hey, if the container has not opened and it's been inspected in the originated container, we don't have to inspect every port or every container, for instance. So all this is not utopian. The interesting thing that you mentioned is that the letter of credit, a bill of lading, there is an army of people that banks employ to verify, validate, because a lot of financial crimes that happen in the space today. So for example, if I get a letter of credit from Bank of Derek, I can use the letter of credit with 5 different companies. So if you're giving me $1 million, I can make that $5 million by just shipping those documents. And that's still the old way of doing stuff. And so what banks have done, banks have employed armies of people in India and Vietnam and all these places to make a bunch of calls. Still, these are MBA, highly educated people. And all they're doing is verifying documents. And what we've done in blockchain world is taking those documents, enciphered them, and make them, treat them like digital asset that I can only send it once to Derek and I cannot reuse it. So it's not utopian, I think, altogether. I think that many financial institutions that we work with are also salivating on use cases around things like, you know, supply chain financing, invoice financing, and then subsequently, you know, securitizing this finance and getting off their books because these are attractive and lucrative lending, working capital loans, like 60-day, 90-day loans, which could potentially have a much higher returns. The financial service industry is still salivating on the same or old traditional practices, while me and you are talking about the fact that, look, it's a token, they can get paid and they can start going about doing their business while the world trade happens. So certainly an interesting mindset, while the financial industry is still saying, okay, how can I monetize this space? Many of us disruptors are thinking that, you know, we can certainly change the way business is done and give birth to new business model, right? So it's an interesting point of view, I think.
And so much of what we've been talking about today is overlaying traditional business models with digitization. I mean, we could have an entire discussion on business models that is simply don't exist now, that didn't exist previously and do exist now because of the digitization of digital assets. So another transactional digitization of digital assets, let's say. And so I think that's, you know, possibly for another time. We haven't even got today, and we're running out of time, but we haven't even got today to discuss the fact that a $3.1 trillion infrastructure bill was held up for some 10 days because they were trying to work out what to do with this digital currency industry. That's a coming of age, isn't it, Nitin? And if I could add an irony to the whole thing, you know, the bill failed. It didn't get passed by one vote, an 89-year-old white bloke from Alabama. Obviously, very educated in the space of digital currencies, and he's made a decision which sees that, you know, this. So I think, you know, we're going to see this grappling of the old traditional economy and regulations with this new regulations. You know, occasionally people say to me, so why isn't there a regulation set for such and such? You can't regulate for what you don't know is happening or going to happen or might happen. You can't regulate. So regulators will always follow behind. They have to, because they can't be ahead because it hasn't been created yet. So there's going to be a certain degree of lag at all times. It's going to be interesting to see this swirling combination of belief systems, cultures, law, vested interests in the traditional finance world and this new world of things that can just happen that way. And that intersection, I guess, is going to keep us entertained for a long time.
No, it does. And I'll tell you this, we all were working behind the scenes because there's a lot of people involved in terms of educating think tanks who educate other think tanks who are actually closer to the lawmakers. And what's interesting is that the U.S., which I'm very proud of, by the way, our political system is very highly decentralized in terms of how decisions are made. And what's irony of this whole thing is that decentralized system is now clashing with another decentralized system, trying to figure out as to what is the economic system that go with it. But to me, that is an inflection point, that we've spent, besides working on bridges and roads, which I can attest to living in the United States, that we do need an upgrade. And it's a long time coming that, you know, we need to fix our bridges and roads and airports. But the majority of the energy was spent on crypto because that's addressing the financial infrastructure of the United States, which is one of the strengths of the country. And to me, that is an inflection point, that if that much energy has gone into it, it's still going on. It's not dead in the sense that, you know, it was not passed in that first round, but it's gone back to the House to be reconsidered and change the language. But behind the scenes, I was appalled by some of the decisions, which is basically trying to regulate technology. And we've always said that technology is boundless. It has no understanding of boundaries or jurisdictions or laws. Technology it permeates everywhere. So instead of focusing on the activities and instruments and business activities, the debate took a different turn in terms of proof of stake, proof of work, which are purely technical concepts.
Yes.
And, you know, like molecules and atoms, the way our world is created, it has no notion of boundaries. And
pushing
so our
protons.
Protons do, right? Right. And so that's where things were, but it's there. And I think to me, that legal battle ensues. But fortunately, and I work with global regulators, surprisingly, the regulatory bodies and regulatory, you know, what we call as College of Regulators, which is the entire alphabet soups that try to discern between securities and commodities and payments and all these things, surprisingly very open and very willing to work with us. I think at some point, regulators can only do so much. It has to be, you know, a legal process from a Congress perspective, which is true for all countries, I think.
Yeah.
So we should spend some time on this. I think we had dedicated a whole session in tearing it apart.
Well, there's a lot of sessions we can dedicate. So for those that are still listening, thank you. As we ramble through and have our conversations, we've really just touched on areas that we find interesting. Going forward, our plan is to do this each week so that you can get a broad understanding of what's happening in the industry, what's moving at the moment, you know, how that might socially impact people, kind of along the lines of Money Reimagined. Now, Michael Casey is a friend of ours. Nitin has presented with him many times, and he used to sit on the advisory board of the Portal Asset Management. And so, great friend. We admire what he does. We like Money Reimagined. And really, this is, in essence, this discussion is going to be the intersection between what's happening in this space and how that impacts society and us as a people. And I particularly find that interesting. I hope you do. If you do, please do your things of subscribing and liking whatever medium this particular video or podcast goes out on. Please feel free to leave comments below. Keep any abusive ones out if possible. But certainly if you want to discuss, hey, you guys, you want to discuss a topic coming up soon, et cetera, throw it in the comments section and we'll discuss it next time around. We're delighted to. We'll also have guests coming on to shoot the breeze with us along the time too. I hope you enjoy it. If you do, please share it with your friends and feel free to comment and we're delighted to respond back. Thanks very much indeed for listening to us.
Thanks, guys.
Bye for now.
See you next week. Bye.